Hello and good evening, good day, good morning to all of you out in your quarantined worlds. It is us from Undying Light bringing you a message not about the coronavirus, because we're not that type of podcast. So while everybody else under their sun has delivered you something, we're not going to. We're going to talk about a new topic, one that Paul and I have been going back and forth on for a while. We finally settled on this, and I think it's hopefully going to be edifying to all of you, and maybe a bit different for what you're used to from us. So that's the intro. Did it under 30 minutes this time.
Cool. What do we got? What's the topic?
The topic is church history.
Boom.
So there it is. Mic drop. And the big issue that we run into is there is a lot of misconceptions within the church body around what actually happened and, you know, what group did what. And, you know, you can claim sometimes years and stuff, but really what we want to get down to the nitty gritty is how did certain things unfold and start to point people in the right direction? Who was responsible for what major issue or, you know, advancement in the church? So that's what we're going to take you through. We've got a lot of history to cover. So this will probably be the rest of our podcast life is church history.
Probably. You know, we're kind of the worst hosts because we said that worst. We wouldn't do a long series again. And now we're doing church history, which is kind of the longest subject you can touch on.
Basically, we are the worst hosts ever. And then on top of you doing a cult series, which has, I don't know, what, like 30 episodes planned? How
that's going to be. I think that now, since we're like in quarantine, I think I'm going to throw 2 episodes per week on that because I have extra time. So,
yeah,
kill it off sooner.
Yeah, and I was hoping to get some stuff recorded this week while I was on vacation, but I was just slammed with schoolwork and then writing the sermon and then for this Sunday. And I just got to like Wednesday and I was just mentally beaten. I couldn't even pick up a book to read. I was just, all I wanted to do was watch movies and just veg for the afternoon. So that's what I did.
I know that feel, man.
Yeah, it's never fun, but, you know, it happens. So
it's good to chill out, though.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely good to unfold. So, all right. So I see you've got quite a bit of notes in here for, looks like, multiple episodes.
I got 5 pages.
Yeah.
So no, this is actually only for episode 1.
Actually, you know what? That's your cult. Because you sent me that one by accident.
I know. I got like 5 on those.
So you got 5 pages here. So depending on time, we probably will break this into a 2-part episode.
Yeah, no problem.
Because there's a lot of meat in here to unpack. And we want people to not have a, you know, headache when they walk away from our episode. So. So I guess without further ado, since everybody's got all the time in the world, but we always seem to be against the clock, I'll let you take it away.
This is a major task, by the way, and I hope we're up to the challenge. Yeah. You can have a lot of church history surveys either heard or read in a book. You have James White's series. He has like 87 episodes on sermon audio. They're pretty good, but he kind of goes in the tangent a lot, but they're awesome. He's a cool guy. You have Ligonier Survey by Dr. Godfrey, which is now for free. You have the books that we bought not so long ago, like $48. How much was that? The series by Philip Schaff.
Yeah, they were like 42 or 45 or 48
or
whatever.
Dirt cheap.
They were cheap. Yeah, and they are fantastic quality.
Yeah, but they're really long and detailed. They can be tedious, and we don't want that for this. So
no. All right.
We're not going to go like this. This is what happened in the 20th year of such and such's life. No, that's not how we're going to handle this. That History of the Church series by Philip Schaff has 8 volumes, and they're long stuff. They're like 900 pages each.
And they're tiny print, too.
Oh, wow. I haven't even seen them yet, because mine were shipped to my U.S. address, so...
Oh, yeah, they are. It's tiny print. It's multiple books, many hundreds of pages each book. So you're talking thousands of pages of content, and it's a very in-depth study. And I bet you between his and Nick's series, not our Nick, but
Nick Needham.
Yeah. Between those two, you're probably going to get a really good in-depth dive, but we didn't want, you know, to cause brain aneurysms, so we are sticking to a bit higher level of history.
Yeah, like a more bird's eye view kind of stuff.
Right.
So yeah, you mentioned Nick Needham's 2000 Years of Christ's Power. It's a lot of fun to read. It's like dynamic, and it's not going to get tedious or boring, unlike what I expect Philip Schaff's books to be. And then you got Justo Gonzalez's work, which is really summarized. I think it's only one book. But anyway, our approach here is going to be like to provide you guys with the main events, characters, years that marked the history of the church until... I don't know if we're going to make it until now. That would be quite a feat to achieve. But that would be awesome. We're not going to be incredibly detailed. It's not going to be like listening to an audiobook. Probably the first couple of episodes will, because there's a lot of information there. And you know, there's such a disregard for church history, especially in Protestant circles. And I just hate how Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy feel like they own church history, and we are like completely helpless when we're talking to them about the history of the church. I just hate that, and that's not how it is. We Protestants are basically the ones who can trace the line through sound teachers back to the apostolic church. So it belongs to us. Mm-hmm. It's the history of the Church of Christ, not the Church of the Pope or of the Eastern Orthodox Patriarch. So we have to study it and enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. I love history. I love pretty much all kinds of history, U.S. history, world history, church history.
Yeah, church history is amazing.
It's really cool. And you get into very, very deep theology also.
Yes, very, very deep.
So to start us off, and Alex, if you got to end it at around 30 or 40 minutes, just cut me off. So yeah, that will be that.
Yeah, I'm going to go eat some pizza. So.
Oh, man, you got to stop with that Chicago pizza. It makes me go crazy with envy, dude.
It's just frozen pizza tonight. Oh, okay.
I'm not jealous. Yeah. I had steak for lunch. Steak and mashed potatoes.
I'm having steak tomorrow before we head home.
So. Watch out with the gout, dude.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Okay, let's...
It's actually, alcohol is what causes issues for me. It's I could eat all the red meat I want.
So oh, that's cool.
Good there. Yeah.
I just had a... I'm probably going to be so judged for this. I just had like 2 little shots of whiskey. I don't like to drink, but I heard this new study that strong alcoholic drinks literally destroy, kill the coronavirus or anything like that. So I just, I gargled a bit on Double Black Johnny Walker.
Nice.
Yeah, man, but it's so strong. I never drink, so I'm not used to that burning sensation down to your stomach.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that'll do it for you.
Yeah, so now I'm corona-free.
There you go. You saved your world. And alienated everybody who listens, because they all think that...
Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drinker. Yeah. Whatever. I've actually never been drunk in my entire life, and that's 28 years, so...
I wish I could say the same.
Yeah. We're all different.
Much wild. Yeah. Much wilder days.
I bet. Mine were wild in a different sense. I was just more stupid. Okay, let's go, dude. Let's do this.
Let's dig into it.
So first, I want to clarify 2 terms that I'm sure you want to clarify too.
Yes,
Catholic absolutely. Does not mean Roman Catholic. So anytime we mention Catholic Church, we do not mean the Roman Catholic Church, or as they love to call themselves, Roman Apostolic Catholic, or Roman Roman Catholic Apostolic. I don't know what the whole name is, but they have a long name. We don't mean that mm-hmm. when we mean Catholic Church. Catholic comes from the Greek Catholicos, which means universal. And following that definition, we should not be ashamed to call ourselves Catholic. I can call myself a Catholic, actually. And I mean I'm mm-hmm. part of the universal church. But the term has such a weight that anyone who uses it and is not a Roman Catholic and is actually a Christian who knows his stuff, it's going to make us cringe and retreat in shame. And actually, Roman Catholic, that terminology by itself is an oxymoron, because you are either defined as a local member of a church in a geographic spot, or you are a universal church. You can't really be a universal Roman. It's just contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
So besides clearing that out, we have to clear out tradition, which Nick has an awesome episode on tradition, by the way, so if you want more on that, you can just go to him. But briefly, tradition is another buzzword that triggers Protestants a lot. Catholic yeah. tradition is not something bad when understood correctly. The term tradition can be used in three different ways. The first one is it's either a school or a way of interpretation, such as Reformed, Lutheran, Arminian, etc. And even though those are not strictly tradition, they can work as such and they can develop into traditions, as we can see in many practices of either Presbyterians, Lutherans, Methodists, even Baptists, who claimed not to have traditions, but traditions. Of course they do. Mm-hmm. My church is Baptist, and we change wine for apple juice, which I really dislike, but mm-hmm. they do it for a noble reason, but I still don't think it's valid. It's mainly for people who go who have had issues with alcohol in their previous life and their non-Christian life. And if they taste the taste of wine, of alcohol in the wine, they might get tempted and fall into some sort of sin. That's the whole reason. But I don't think that changing an ordinance or a sacrament, whatever you want to call it, I don't think that changing it for the sake of people who walk right. in, I don't think anyone should do that. But I don't think it's a sin either, like, oh, you're now disqualified from being a true church or anything like that. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
I think that if you present it as a stumbling block, it should be provided as an option, but I don't think you should change the root of the sacraments being bread and wine. So I think juice or grape juice or whatever should be provided as a secondary choice or an option, because there's a lot of people that I know that won't drink alcohol out of fear of past lives, and that's fine. But I also think that it should just be provided secondary and not to change the entire sacrament, but that's my view.
I just never thought of that. You just solved like my whole church's issue. I'm not even kidding, dude.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the first one, the first way of seeing tradition. It's how the ancient church, for example, through those traditions of interpretation, that's how they came to define the essentials. That's how the ancient church came to define the Trinity or Christology or the canon of the Bible. We just take those terms for granted, but the church spent literally thousands of hours hammering out a solid expression of those doctrines.
Mm-hmm.
The second way you can see tradition being used is the teachings of the apostles not contained in scripture. That is what Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox believe and practice. We don't agree with that, of course. We don't believe right. that tradition can have some sort of God-breathed impact. Status outside of the Bible yeah. through which it can teach people stuff that is not contained in the Bible. We don't agree with that at all. And tradition can also be defined, as Roman Catholics currently define it, as if it is something that evolves. It's something ancient, but it truly isn't. Like, for example, the Marian dogmas that were defined in the 19th century. They claim that the ancient church did believe in them in the sense of being like embryo form. They were there, but not really expressed fully. And now, 1,900 years later, they're suddenly clear. That's like the evolution of tradition, and that's inherent in Roman Catholic belief. And that in it's defined by the magisterium and papal infallibility, which we completely reject.
Yep.
Apart, I mean, except if it's from you, Alex, because you're like the Pope.
I am the Pope. Yep.
So you have the the chair.
I have the authority to make the rules.
There you go. So what what rule are you making about these coward faith healers who are nowhere to be seen now that the coronavirus is literally eating the world up?
If I had my choice, I would walk up and bar every one of their church's doors and kick them to the curb. The fact that people still follow them shows a massive lack of ignorance in the church body today, and it just shows a massive amount of lack of knowledge, not just in church history, but just in simple biblical knowledge. And you don't have to be a Bible scholar to understand that these people are frauds. And, you know, I think Chris Rosenbrough tackles it perfectly when he says that, you know, where were these guys in January when this was starting to erupt in China and nobody made predictions about it? You all predicted a year of plentiful and bountiful and everybody's going to be happy. And here we are 3 months later, locked in our homes, not able to buy toilet paper. Where were you at, prophets? Come on now.
Oh, man. They're so pathetic.
They are terrible.
And they just hide. That's what's most annoying. Yeah. At least be like, I'm sorry to say this. May God forgive me. At least be like Kenneth Copeland, who tells you to touch the TV so you can be healed.
Yeah, exactly.
Like try to cover your crap, but just hiding out and weathering out ugly stuff. Man, I'm so triggered at those guys.
Yep, agents of Satan. Man.
Yeah, and as you said, it should be common sense to just reject them and qualify them as false prophets, but the blindness, the spiritual blindness of these people is so big that they just can't see through. Okay, let's keep going with actual church history and not, well, this is going to go into the annals of church history, but when we're long gone, if we're still here, if Christ has not returned.
Yeah.
So we have to begin this whole journey. Dude, we're going to be 35. I'm going to be 35 when we finish this series. So
I'll be dead. I mean, if you take it 2,000 years of church history and we do like a group of years every, you know, two or three times a month, we're not going to do this.
I know.
This will literally be the staple of our podcast. It should be changed from Undying Light to, you know, the light that never made it to the end of the tunnel. Because this train will never be
running out
there.
Of batteries.
Running out of batteries. Hey, my laptop died right before we started recording this. So that must be a sign to not do
task. I'm going to call someone to make a logo. Dying batteries.
Dying batteries.
Okay, so we have to begin by looking at the background of the Apostolic Church. And for that, we have to understand the history behind its foundation and its setting, which is Rome and Israel. And we're going to begin with Rome. So we have to begin, of course, with the Roman Empire. That was the setting. But we have to know where the Roman Empire came from. The Roman Empire dominated all of Mediterranean Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa. And big empires are not easy to unite or to maintain under order. The post-republic empire was ruled by one single man, as opposed to a senate, so it was basically a tyrant, that's the Caesar. And Rome was founded as a city, Rome itself was founded in the 8th century BC as a kingdom. Then in 510 BC, it was transformed into a republic through a revolution, where the senate was the governing body of the republic, which was dominated pretty much by the upper classes. And it was basically an oligarchy, dominated by very few people. Kind of like most emerging countries nowadays. Actually, Chile, the country I live in, is kind of like ruled in a hidden sense by an oligarchy, by people who have like $25 billion fortune.
Interesting.
Yeah, they have a lot of weight here. So whatever they say kind of goes. And the president is a sellout, so whatever.
Typical.
So Rome began expanding its borders as a republic throughout the 3rd century. And then it burst into wars through many anarchical groups. There was this rampant anarchy in Rome. Many civil wars erupted until there was a ripple effect in the whole thing, and it was unstoppable. And like many examples, as we see throughout history, and recently in the likes of communist revolutions, there is always a supreme leader or head of the movement that is needed after tough times of revolution or war. And ironically enough, that those revolutions are planned by the same people who end up in power. So the Roman Republic saw itself in that situation. They needed someone to step up to calm the whole thing down. The civil wars were erupting everywhere. Anarchy was rampant. The Senate could not handle it. So that is where you have Julius Caesar step in. He was supposed to step in as the man for the job. But a group of senators who didn't want the Republic to be abolished, they had him killed right before he could rise to power. And instead of helping their cause, Julius's death caused more isolated civil wars until his nephew, Octavius Caesar, who is later known as Augustus, he rose to power and defeated all his rivals. And finally, he took supremacy over all the Roman territories in 31 BC, and he created what we know as the Roman Empire. And then in 27 BC, the now subject Senate gave Octavius the title of Augustus, which means August or Exalted One. And that title would later develop, and it would come to mean deity. They actually saw the emperors as deity. Now, Octavius restored peace to the empire. It was seen by many citizens as divinely sent. And he was the emperor for a really long time. He was the emperor until AD 14. So Octavius was the emperor when Christ was born and through most of his childhood. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is.
How it all connects. And we don't really see Octavius mentioned in the Bible, but I'm sure that all the New Testament writers knew who he was.
Yeah, very familiar with him, of course.
So now let's touch a bit on Roman culture. The Roman culture and religion wasn't really originated in Rome. It was originated in Greece. The Greek culture and religious philosophy spreads out in the 4th century BC through the military campaigns of Alexander the Great, who was a military genius. And if you don't know about his children, we're going to get to that, but whatever. You have something to say?
No, I was just going to agree that he was a military genius.
He was awesome, dude.
If you've ever studied like warfare and things like that, his name's always in there.
He had like a tiny kingdom, the Macedonian kingdom, and literally just conquered pretty much all of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like Hitler, but he didn't fail. Thankfully, Hitler failed. When the empire of Alexander the Great broke up, it was left to his sons. And that's how the Hellenistic culture, and by the way, Hellas means Greece in Greek. That's where you get the word Hellenism or Hellenistic. That's where the Greek philosophy, Greek culture, Greek everything spread everywhere. Some of you may have noticed that the book of Daniel prophesies the breakup of Alexander's kingdom into he had 4 sons. I forgot the name of the empires now, but they are in the book of Daniel. They are prophesied by Daniel, and Daniel gets a lot of dirt for that from liberal scholars. And they say that Daniel had to write all of this after Alexander's kingdom was broken up into his sons' kingdoms, because no one could have known that with such detail. But Daniel prophesies that perfectly. It's really awesome to study. So when Rome began its expansion, it adopted Hellenism and developed Greek art, literature, science, and even the language was also more predominant in many places of the Roman Empire than Latin was. In the western half of the empire, pretty much everyone knew Greek. And in the eastern half, only the most educated people knew Greek as their second language. It was pretty much as today's English in the world. in ancient Rome. Greek was the like a common language. That's why the New Testament was written in Koine Greek. Koine means common. Most of the eastern half of the empire spoke in Greek. Now, in terms of religion, we have, and we're going to get into some really weird stuff here. I know you've already, you know this, Alex, because you've read pretty much the same history books as I have, so you're not going to be as shocked. But the first time I read it, dude, some of the practices they had, yuck. I mean, I could just imagine. We have the popular religion of the Roman Empire. It was also assimilated from Hellenism, from Greek culture and Greek religion. The Greek pantheon was literally just carried on to Rome, and it was formed, that's what formed the Roman pantheon. So well-known gods such as Zeus, Poseidon, Ares, Aphrodite, and more, they were simply gods for everyday life, and they were carried on from Greece and turned into Jupiter, Neptune, Mars, and Venus, respectively. They relied on these gods for agriculture, romance, business, war. They had like one god for each thing, which is pretty it's pretty interesting to see.
Yeah.
And the emperor, this is a really interesting term. The emperor was a high priest of the common religion of the Roman Empire, and he was called, get a load of this, Pontifex Maximus. Who else is called like that? The Pope.
Yeah, that's true. Shocking.
I don't know if that's an anachronism from us, because you have, of course, the Greek and Latin language, and probably since the Pope sees himself as Christ's representative now, like the vicar, probably that's how he adopted the name Pontifex Maximus, but it's still kind of ironic how they claim to be the true church, and they hail their names and titles from Roman paganism.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I don't know how much longer you can go.
Let's finish with Rome.
Okay.
And then we'll cut it.
Cool, because we got a ton of episodes here.
Yeah.
Where were we? Pontifex Maximus. So the great power of the Roman Empire led people to believe that the highest deity was at work through the emperor. And that belief developed to such an extent that the emperor himself was later deemed a god. As we see with Octavius Caesar, he was later renamed Augustus, which means exalted one or deity even. Hellenism saw kings as divine figures, so it was only natural to carry that from Hellenism into the Roman pagan religion. And to see the king himself, the Caesar, as divinely appointed. So some claimed they worshipped the genius of the emperor, or the power that was working behind the emperor, but they couldn't really hide for long that they were actually worshipping the emperor himself. We have other religions present in the empire aside from Judaism, and they were comprised by many, they're called mystery cults. The four major cults were dedicated to God, to the goddesses, Cybele, Isis, which is not the terrorist group composed by Muslims now, Serapis, and Mithras. We have Mithraism that rivaled Christianity some centuries in the future, at around the 3rd and 4th century. We have the cult of Isis, who were known for rampant acts of worship involving sexual immorality and trance-like states. They probably had temple prostitutes, much like the pagans of the Old Testament. And we have other mystery cults that, this is the nasty part, they had to do initiation rites into some of these cults, which made them more personal, because the Roman pagan religion was kind of like stoic in a sense. You couldn't really have communion with the gods or with one another. You had like your own gods and you carried your own life that way.
Yeah, they would have statues of their own personal god in their house. And you would worship that particular god. And it was interesting because you could, you know, you might be the only one that, you know, recognizes this god in your whole town, while 80% of the rest of the town recognizes other gods. It's just, it's interesting that, like you said earlier, how they each had, you know, you had a god for everything. And so everybody literally could have their own personal god.
Yeah, like you have generals that I'm pretty sure people have seen this in many like ancient based movies. Like there's one, man, I forgot what it was called. Like the latest one. Is it Risen? Risen is pretty good. I liked it. It's based on it's not actual history, but it's pretty good. There's another one.
Paul.
Forget. Paul the Apostle.
Yeah, that one was good.
You have the, is it the Roman procurator?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have him like debating others. What kind of God do you like today?
Yeah, exactly.
Since he's like a war general, pretty much. He's like, I like Mars. Or others have Minerva, that I forgot her role. But I know Mars is the god of war. So generals probably prayed to Mars a lot. People who were in the... on in the prostitution business probably prayed to ISIS if they were part of mystery cults. Fishers who were Romans probably prayed to Poseidon or Neptune, which they called him. It's a pretty interesting dynamic which they had anyway. So one of the initiation rites of these cults, check it out. They had new members would be locked inside a pit with a wooden lid with holes in it. And then the cult would sacrifice a bull on top and let all the blood flow on the novice until every part of their body was covered in the blood. The new member also looked upwards with their mouth open and drank the warm blood. They had to have every single part of their body covered in the blood, and it conferred, supposedly, of course, it conferred immortality on the member of the cult.
Delicious. You know, I was watching I love history, and so I watch Josh Gates. He does a show on Travel Channel, and he's doing this like a whole series on like the origins of humanity. And he went to this ancient tribe in Africa, and in order for them to allow Josh to film on their like land, he had to go through their initiation process. And so they take a calf out of their herd and they stab the calf's neck, and the blood pours out into a cup, you know, and then they solderize the wound and the calf's fine.
Oh,
but then then Josh has to drink it like right there.
Yuck, dude.
And they show it, and I'm like, oh, I had to fast forward. I'm like, that is not what I do. It's way too much.
He drank it though?
Drank it, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
He's one of those guys that will you know, he's been through all over the world, so he's had all sorts of different cultures and food, and
he would basically really eat slugs.
He does, and he's had it's creepy, man. It's so that's not what I deal with. Mm-mm.
The Bear Grylls of the culinary world.
Exactly.
That's so nasty. I can never drink warm blood.
No.
I don't know if you've had black sausage.
Maybe.
So they're basically like coagulated blood.
Yeah.
With spices and onions. I had them a lot. Yeah. Now I just can't. They're, I don't know. Just knowing that it's pig blood mixed with stuff. And too drinking much. It while it's warm. Dude, no. And it can also be dangerous.
Yeah, it can very much be dangerous.
You can have coronavirus.
Coronavirus.
So that will be it for... We just got done with Rome, their culture, and their religion. Next episode is going to be philosophy of the first century. And then Judea with Judaism, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like a basic introduction. Then we get to the actual early church and...
Yep.
Their most prominent characters in that, and events and works that they did. And interestingly enough, you know, I sent you and Nick someone that I spoke with over Instagram, challenging him to a debate, because this person said that it's actually faithless not to have a service with this coronavirus thing going around, and that the early church would have completely wiped out this virus with their faith and with their gifts. And this person is, of course, a charismatic I don't know if he defines himself as charismatic, but he supports the position that the gifts continue nowadays. Mm-hmm. So I challenged him and actually told him that's incredibly irresponsible and so naive. And just, I don't know, man. It just shocked me. How can someone say that when you know that there are old people in a church and kids and families? And if someone infected goes, the whole place is going to get it.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I think what's insultive in these types of people is that they have the audacity to challenge people's faith.
Right.
Because if you don't have the ability to exhibit the gifts, which guess what, you won't, then you don't have faith. And we've already made a witness to all of these faith healers that they're not out healing people. So we know that the gift of healing isn't real. Now, the second point, if you want to talk about prophecy and tongues, we can denounce the prophecy because none of the prophets, quote unquote, were able to predict the coronavirus.
Right.
And then we get to tongues and we just say, well, what good is tongues? Because you don't need to learn how to speak another language because that's the biblical context of tongues. Now, I don't denounce against the gifts of the Spirit from Galatians 5. I don't suggest that people are unable to be, had to exhibit certain gifts that God may instill upon you. But those three that people seem to love to hang on are just predominantly Protestant and or not Protestant, Pentecostal.
Yeah.
And they have only really been around for the last 120 years.
Yeah, and they're not actually, well, yeah, the how can you call it? Like the garbage manifestation. Because it's not really a gift. It's just they're phony gifts. Those aren't gifts. They're just, what's the word I'm looking for, dude? They are, I don't know, like a bad copy, like plagiarism of the true gift. They're just not real. You don't have, and even charismatics admit this, you don't have the true gift of prophecy now because people get it wrong the whole time or they just don't get it or get something that is completely irrelevant or just something that's too detailed. Like, hey, God is going to forgive your debt and going to give you all the money back next month and nothing happens and the person is broke and has to live, under a bridge somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So you just don't have the gifts that we see are clear in the Bible. You don't have them now. You don't have people going with aprons and their shadows healing all the hospitals filled with coronavirus infected people. Right. And you don't have, American missionaries going to Japan and speaking fluent Japanese. You just don't have that. So you have to make this makeshift definition of gifts in order to be relevant or latch on to your assumptions about doctrine and about gifts.
And it's very watered down. So let me ask you this. Read the Bible and find me a prophet anywhere that was ever wrong. A prophet from God. Not like Baal's prophets, but a prophet from God. Can you show me biblical proof that they were wrong at any given point?
Never.
Because if they were wrong, then they should be disqualified as being a prophet.
They would have been stoned, actually.
Yeah. So how can we allow prophets today to be wrong on anything? Any prophet given, how can they be wrong?
I once heard that the prophet can misinterpret God's communication to him.
That has never happened in scripture either.
No, and it's still ridiculous because you're saying that God can fallibly give prophecy to someone.
Right. So ridiculous.
But anyway, where I was going with that is this person called me like, I see the gifts as something so important and essential that any Christian should understand and accept that I'm really not up to any sort of communion or conversation or debate with anyone who does not hold to all the gifts being like here. So then I just We went back and forth for a while, and I was telling him, hey, if you think this is such an important subject, then why are you not willing to discuss it for tens, if not hundreds, of people will listen to your essential truth? And my point with this is that the early church, when they began producing literature, it was basically designed and meant to combat heresy. They didn't just write stuff out of nowhere. For the sake of devotions or deep doctrine, they did end up doing that, but it was mainly because they had to fight heresy. And the only way to fight heresy is by having a solid stance on doctrine. So that's what the early church did, and that's what we're going to see in the two episodes from now.
Yep, and... You know, it's funny, too, that you said that. I mean, just look at Paul's letter to the Galatians. Why did he write to the church? I mean...
Heresy.
Because of heresy. So, look at Peter's letters. Look at John's letters. They were all to counteract those who were opposing the gospel of Jesus Christ.
And you know, that bears to mind that if you believe someone else is in heresy or in wrong doctrine, and if you're unwilling to stand up to that and correct them or have a live discussion or a live debate, then you are in the wrong spot. You are not in the spot that the apostles were in, and you're not where the early church was.
Yep. Well, it's just like yesterday that as soon as I got in to my in-laws, somebody made a comment on a post of mine and then DM'd me. And claiming that I was wrong because I held to the five solas. So I said, hey, let's go on live right now and let's duke it out. We'll talk about how Mary being sinless is not a possible thing. And it almost happened. He was on there for a few minutes and then it like the disconnect, you know, he had terrible internet. I think his potato died. So you know, but that's the thing. You have to be willing to understand doctrine, and that's what we're going to hopefully help to unpack here is how through the early church, we'll see how the branches started to form in terms of how the different denominations came about over time and how the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church came about, the popes came about, and how quickly after, it was only a few hundred years really after the Apostolic Church, and how the Roman Catholics just went haywire and started down their road of heresy. And so I'm loving this. This is a great series.
Yeah, it's going to be really useful for us also because we get to practice a lot.
Yeah. So,
and it's just fun overall.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I hope that, you know, this is going to be a lot of information download for you guys, but at the same time, we will encourage you to pick up these books that we read and we study from, and we want you to just to familiarize yourself with these events, and because it doesn't hurt to understand the entire Bible and then what happened between then and today.
Right.
Because that's how you get today's service. And then I'll tell you what, you may walk into a church service and say, why are we doing this stuff? You know, the early church never did it, or why, you know, because you talked about traditions. Churches have traditions. So, you know, where did that tradition come from? Can we challenge that tradition? Is that biblical or is it man-made? Yeah. And so those are things that hopefully over the course of the time we're doing the series, we can unpack for you.
And a lot of people think, most of all Protestants, that church history only started at the Reformation.
Yeah.
And that's not so.
No.
And we're going to see how it develops through the... ancient times, Middle Ages. The Middle Ages is probably the best period. It's so much fun to study. The Reformation, we all kind of know a bit about the Reformation, and it's amazing how God just lifted up the church out of all that gunk that it was in. But anyway, it's gonna be cool.
Yeah, we hope you stick around for it, and we hope that you guys are edified and you guys enjoy this. And And as always, Paul and I will continue doing the solo shows on the side as we're unpacking that material for you. But we're looking forward to doing this together, and we hope that you guys enjoy it.
Maybe having Nick or Jason on every once in a while.
Yeah. We got some smart people that we hang out with that are smarter than us. Yeah. So we'll we'll get them on and let them talk and ramble. So you're not bored out with our dull voices. But on that note, I'm going to go eat some pizza. And then I'm going to go to bed and drive 4 hours home tomorrow. So,
oh, man.
Lucky me. So I can go back to my work and sit at a desk while everybody's panicking about the coronavirus. Yeah. Okay. If only I could quit my job this week, I would.
Oh, man. I'm sorry for that, but stick around because they're gonna be it's gonna be mass unemployment soon. So
it's gonna be ridiculous. Yeah. So guys, stay in prayer and do whatever you can to keep your jobs. Don't.
Yeah, and don't get granny or grandpa infected.
Yeah, yeah. Stay away from people. Take care of yourselves. Wash your hands, you sinners. That's what I'm gonna leave it on. So guys. Thanks for tuning in, and until next time, stay reformed and wash your hands.
True. Wash your hands. And wash the dishes.
Wash your dishes, you sinners.